Near the end of his life, Martin Buber, a Jewish philosopher, started collecting stories from the Hasidic Jewish movement. Now, the Hasidic movement started in 18th century Eastern Europe as a rejection of what had become a very formal Talmudic practice. Hasidism teaches that life should be lived with fervor and exalted in joy. This morning's story for all ages comes from that tradition, a tradition far from my own, and yet I can relate to this story as if it were mine. This parable teaches that the greatest treasures exist right here, right where we stand, under our own hearth, under our own heart. But, you know, the more I think about Rabbi Isaac's story, the more I hear another teaching running underneath it. A teaching I also hear running underneath my own personal story. And that's the great thing about stories, even our own. We can revisit them from time to time and find new meaning. This kind of cuts against my grain. I have this personality that likes to go forward, and I tend not to want to look back. But I found that it's very valuable to look back on your own life, and you find new things all the time as you retell those stories. So let's go back to Rabbi Isaac's story. Let's go back to Isaac sitting in his humble abode. He is visited by a recurring dream that propels him to some distant place. Now, he's probably a family man, probably has a spouse and some children. His family is probably outraged that he would even think about leaving them to run this fool's errand. He most likely doesn't work for someone who's going to give him vacation pay to take this treasure hunt. He may even have a congregation that is wondering about the soundness of his judgment. But he does it anyway. Maybe he slips away in the night. Maybe he leaves in broad daylight with babies screaming and crying after Papa. He hits the road. For days, for weeks, he walks and walks until his shoes are shreds. All the while, he carries a picture in his mind of finding the great treasure and bringing it back to his family. Like the rabbi, I too felt something propelling me toward distant places. I first noticed that urging or that voice. It started a long time ago in a Unitarian church, actually. I would sit in the back of the sanctuary every Sunday and cry, very discreetly. I had no idea why I was crying. My life was good, or so it seemed. I had nothing to cry about. I had a good career. I was married to my first husband, hometown sweetheart. We had bought our first house. It was one of those urban renewal projects, a narrow shotgun row house in Baltimore. We were active in the community. We had friends and a busy social schedule. And although we were not rich, we had all the money that we wanted. And yet, when I sat there in church, I thought I could hear some distant music, something that could not be heard with the ears, but a sound heard with the heart, a sound that I wanted to follow. But not knowing what to do with these feelings, I just pulled myself together and walked into coffee hour with dry eyes. Like Rabbi Isaac, who ignored his recurring dreams at first, I ignored all of these feelings for a while. Over time, I could see that even though my life was materially full, it was spiritually empty. A person can cruise through life for a long time being spiritually empty, as long as everything else is pretty stable. But once that material life starts to sour, then there's nothing to fall back on. Life in the city had grown cold and hard. Our house had been broken into several times. My bicycles were stolen. I was mugged on the way home from school. And frankly, I was tired of the dirt and grime of the city. And then the hardest blow. In trying to have children, we lost 2 pregnancies. My life felt hollow. We had taken a vacation once to the Gulf Coast of Florida, Sarasota, St. Pete, surrounded by palm trees, pelicans, and the soft pink sand. I inhaled the beauty and my heart sang. This is what my heart yearned for, I thought. This must be the source of that distant music that I have been hearing. And so we moved to Florida. Land of blooming flowers, full of life, why not? We both quit our jobs, knowing that we would find something. But it wasn't long before this life, too, seemed to go sour. Standing on the beach, watching the low-flying pelicans and the children digging in the sand, I heard a voice speak. It was my rational, judgmental mind. What in the world are you doing here? Look what you've done. You've moved to a place where everyone is a tourist, a waiter, or a snowbird. You're hundreds of miles away from your family and your church and your friends. You're stuck in this miserable job as a software consultant, flying in and out of town every week, and your marriage is falling apart. You made a huge mistake. Instead of finding treasure, I found the familiar hollowness I thought I had left behind. Rabbi Isaac didn't find what he was looking for either. When he climbed that last ridge, he saw the bridge leading to the king's palace, and then his heart sank. He never imagined there would be so many guards. For the next few days and nights, he watched the bridge, hoping to find some way to start digging around that bridge, but he could find none. He would find no treasure in Prague. As he stood there, dejected, he heard a voice speak. What in the world are you doing here? Now, this voice came from the captain of the guards. For me, this is the most telling part of the rabbi's story. Rabbi Isaac's mind, his rational mind, must have been spinning and screaming, "Don't say anything, just leave. You've already squandered your money, left your family unprotected, and now you could be thrown in jail or even killed. Tell them you're just waiting for somebody, or that you've lost something here in the tall grass, but for heaven's sakes, don't tell him the truth." But Rabbi Isaac wasn't listening to that voice. He was tuned into something else, a different sound, a resonance that was feeling like something was working alongside him. He was tuned into a different frequency, and so he decided to tell the guard about his dream, about the buried treasure underneath the king's bridge. And you know the rest of the story. His mistaken trip to Prague turned out to be brilliant. And my mistaken trip to Florida and the apparently aimless wanderings that followed it turned out to be brilliant too. But much time would pass before I was able to understand this. despite all the complaining I did about those hours on the airplane and all those nights in sterile hotel rooms as I was doing my consulting job, one very good thing did happen. I picked up a book on the road called The Miracle of Mindfulness by Thich Nhat Hanh. Now, I had been reading about Buddhism on and off, but I had not made a practice of it until I read these words, and they struck a chord in me. Be a bud sitting in a hedge. Be a smile, one part of wondrous existence. Stand here. There is no need to depart. With these words, I began my meditation practice, sitting on a folded-up towel on a hotel room floor facing the wall. Without knowing it, I was cultivating a practice of deep listening. I was learning how to listen to the song of the universe and learning how to recognize it in the daily motions of my life. Increasingly, I found that even as my soul was leaning into the music, my feet and my hands were still moving to the rhythm of my old life. This dissonance led me to finally quit my job, separate from my husband, and move to Korea. I held a secret hope that I might find a new home there, going to my homeland. I thought I might further deepen my practice of listening to the hum of the universe. But once again, I found myself realizing that this wasn't the right place either. And I began to wonder if rightness or wrongness of place was even the real issue. I sat on the banks of the Han River in Seoul one late, muggy summer night, and I heard my rational mind start to chatter again, but it wasn't as strong as before. I was learning to turn down the volume on my critical self-talk and listen more keenly to the hum of the universe, just as Rabbi Isaac did. I was better able to let go of expectation and open up myself to the presence of a cooperating universe, able to expect nothing and live frugally on surprise. A year after that night on the Han River, I was in Berkeley, about to start seminary. This time, my rational mind was quiet, and I felt a sense of trust about whatever was going to happen from that point forward. So, what does retracing the ground covered by these two stories teach me about my life now? It teaches me that the creation, the universe, life, gives off a hum, a music of the spheres, if you will, and it is constantly playing. I believe that this music of life tends toward goodness and creativity and love. And human beings can learn to hear this hum, not by training the ear, because it is not perceived by the ear, but by your entire being. You can learn to hear this hum by listening differently. Learn to listen to the silence. Learn to listen to the earth. Learn to listen to another person, even when she or he is not speaking. When you listen for the resonance between your life and the unfolding of the universe, and then when you change the way you act in the world to be resonant with it, you will live a life that is fuller and more satisfying. It's hard to listen for that hum, though, if your mind is constantly talking to you, telling you that if you'd only just work harder and gather more information, then you'll make all the right decisions, you'll be the one in control, and if you make a mistake, well, that's just because you're not good enough. when the only thing you can hear is your rational mind, then it is impossible to expect nothing and live frugally on surprise. The mind cannot conceive of that. For those who want to turn down the constant chatter of the mind, it's hard, I know. It's hard to listen for that universal hum because we live in the midst of noise and chaos and static. And when people cannot hear, then their actions tend to be driven by individualistic and self-centered needs. And that's why we need to cultivate a practice of listening for this resonance. Each one of you can find your own practice. It doesn't have to be one communal practice. This is not about abandoning rational thinking, about just leaving it to the universe to take care of your life. This does not mean shutting down your mind and letting the cosmic forces take over. This is not about passivity or mindlessness. Nor is this a formula that you can follow that will make your life free of mistakes. It's about getting beyond the realm of mistake and non-mistake. It's about following a logic that is more profound and more immense than the human mind, because human beings are co-creators of life. We are co-operators in life. As long as I am listening to the hum of the universe and moving my hands and feet, and yes, my mind to its rhythms, I am confident that my life will be full and as satisfying as it can be. And that's enough. So may it be. Amen.